He didn't come for money. He didn't rape. He didn't even always bring his own weapon. What he brought was fear. Beginning in 1918, the city of New Orleans, already swollen with jazz, migration, and racial tension, was gripped by a phantom who murdered in total silence. Victims were bludgeoned with their own axes. Doors were chiseled open. The killer left no fingerprints, no clear motive, and no trace, only shattered skulls and a trail of blood that crisscrossed the Crescent City. But then came the letter. A public note from someone calling himself the Axeman. He declared he would strike again, but promised to spare anyone playing jazz. That night, the entire city pulsed with live music. Dance halls stayed open. Radios blared. New Orleans, terrified and trembling, tried to outplay death itself. More than a century later, the identity of the Axeman remains unknown. But the truth hiding in those smoky streets and bloody bedrooms is far stranger than any fiction. This wasn't just a killing spree, it was a performance, and the audience was complicit. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. A City Haunted by Jazz and Blood, New Orleans, 1918. A city dancing to jazz and dying by axe. New Orleans in the early 20th century was unlike any other American city. The air was thick with muggy heat, the smell of tobacco and rum drifting from riverboats docked along the Mississippi. Horse-drawn carts clattered down cobbled streets, and brass bands burst from the corners of Storyville. The city was alive, sensual, lawless, racialized, religious, and possessed by music. Jazz was in its infancy, growing wild in the bars and brothels of Basin Street. But that same spirit, the chaos and contradiction, was what made New Orleans vulnerable. And in May of 1918, something terrible seeped in between the notes. It began quietly, as these things often do. The first murder, Joseph and Catherine Maggio. On the morning of May 23rd, 1918, grocer Andrew Maggio stumbled into his brother Joseph's apartment in the quiet Upper Ninth Ward. What he found would set off one of the most terrifying killing sprees in American history. Joseph and his wife Catherine had been hacked to death in their bed. Their throats were slashed with a straight razor. Catherine's head was nearly severed. The killer had then taken an axe and bludgeoned their already dead bodies for good measure. There was no forced entry. Nothing was stolen. A panel had been carefully chiseled out of the door, just large enough to unlock it from the inside. The razor? It had been left in the bathroom. The axe, taken from the couple's own home. Blood smeared the floor, but the most haunting detail was the silence. Neighbors had heard nothing, not a scream, not a thud. The police suspected Andrew Maggio himself. He claimed he'd been drinking heavily the night before, celebrating his discharge from the Navy. But the timing was suspicious. He lived in the same house and said he hadn't heard a thing until morning. Still, there was no proof and no motive. The press seized on the brutality. A mad butcher was loose in New Orleans. Then, just weeks later, he struck again. The rise of the phantom. On June 27th, 1918, Louis Bissouma and his mistress, Harriet Lowe, were found attacked in the back of Bissouma's grocery. They had been sleeping, just like the Maggios. The intruder had again removed a panel from the door and used an axe taken from the scene. Bissouma survived a skull fracture. Harriet's face was partially paralyzed. She lingered in the hospital, slipping in and out of consciousness. Police arrested Bissouma himself, suspicious of the affair and his German heritage. Anti-immigrant paranoia was high. World War I was still raging. The press painted him as a possible German spy, Even though evidence was lacking, days turned into weeks. Harriet Lowe eventually died from complications, but there was no conviction. In August, the killer struck again, this time with fatal precision. The Schneider attack, a pregnant woman, left alive. On August 5th, 1918, Anna Schneider, 8 months pregnant, was attacked in her sleep. Her scalp was gashed open. Her husband had been working a night shift and returned home to find her blooded, barely alive. Yet, shockingly, she and her unborn baby both survived. The police again found no forced entry. An axe was discovered in the yard. People began to panic. Women bought revolvers. Men took to sleeping in shifts. The killer seemed to target Italian grocers, but it wasn't consistent. And despite repeated patterns, sleeping victims, chiseled doors, stolen axes, the city's leaders were hesitant to acknowledge a serial killer. The idea of evil moving with such quiet purpose was too terrifying. But the axeman wasn't done. The Cortimiglia slaughter. A child dies on March 10th, 1919. The killer delivered one of his most savage blows. Rose and Charles, Cortimiglia, lived in Gretna, just across the Mississippi River. Charles was a grocer, like most of the victims. That night, screams ripped through the neighborhood. When help arrived, they found Charles bleeding on the floor, Rose covered in blood, and their 2-year-old daughter Mary, cradled in her mother's arms, dead. The killer had used the same method. Entry through a door panel, the family's own axe. This time, though, Rose survived, and shockingly accused their neighbor, Frank Giordano, of the attack. Giordano, a teenager, and his father were arrested and convicted. But something didn't add up. There was no motive, no physical evidence. Giordano was over 200 pounds, and witnesses claimed it would have been impossible for him to squeeze through the small, chiseled opening. Years later, the case against him collapsed, and both men were released. But by then, the damage was done. The real killer, whoever he was, had struck again and vanished. The letter that changed everything. Then came the letter. Published in the Times-Picayune on March 14, 1919, it was written in a mocking tone and signed, Hell, March 13, 1919. The writer claimed to be the axeman himself. He declared, They have never caught me, and they never will. They have never seen me. For I am invisible, even as the ether that surrounds your earth. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a demon from the hottest hell. But it wasn't just a rant, it contained a challenge. I am fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared, in whose home a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have just mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well then so much the better for you, people. One thing is certain, and that is that some of those persons who do not jazz it on Tuesday night, March 19th, will get the axe. The entire city erupted. Dance halls stayed open all night. Bars hired musicians on short notice. Households, white, black, rich, poor, filled their parlors with music. Jazz, once viewed by some as scandalous, was now a literal lifesaver. And that night, true to his word, the axeman killed no one. Was it a hoax? A ploy for attention? A media invention? Or had the real killer truly written it? No one could say. But the murders weren't over. The final murders. On August 10th, 1919, grocer Steve Boker was attacked in his home. He lived. A week later, Sarah Lauman was found with a cracked skull. She too survived. And on October 27th, 1919, Mike Pepitone was murdered in his bedroom. His wife claimed to have seen two figures fleeing the scene. Blood soaked the room, but the pattern remained. Door panel, missing axe, silence. Then just like that, it stopped. No more attacks. No more letters. No suspects brought to trial. The axemen of New Orleans disappeared like a phantom into the muggy night air, but the fear he left behind lingered, tainting jazz with dread and turning every creak in the night into a warning. And yet, as we'll see in Chapter 2, this was no ordinary string of murders, because beneath the terror was a city already boiling with racial suspicion, political corruption, and spiritual panic. The Axeman wasn't just killing people. He was exposing something rotten at the core of New Orleans itself. Chapter 2. The Devil in the Music. When fear becomes ritual, even the devil wears a jazz suit. The Axeman wasn't just a killer. He was an idea, a force that tapped into every fear festering in New Orleans in 1918 and 1919. Each brutal murder was more than blood on a pillow. It was a message that power could come from nowhere, that silence could kill, that the laws didn't apply when the city refused to admit something unnatural had entered its bloodstream. But to truly understand why the Axeman was never caught, we have to understand what New Orleans really was, a city of blurred lines, between race and class, between politics and crime, between Catholic saints and voodoo spirits, between the living and the dead, and maybe, just maybe, between man and monster. A city already possessed long before the Axeman, New Orleans had been a city of dark magic and forgotten graves. Catholicism and Haitian voodoo had intertwined through centuries of colonial brutality. Hoodoo rituals flourished in back alleys. Graveyards overflowed with above-ground tombs to prevent bodies from floating in floodwater. People lived beside death and made peace with it. And jazz? Jazz wasn't just music. It was conjure. It was resistance. It was how poor black musicians, barred from conservatories, denied formal training, remixed gospel, blues, and African rhythm into something the white establishment feared and desired in equal measure. When the Axeman threatened to kill anyone not playing jazz, he wasn't just terrifying people. He was baptizing them into the city's deeper madness. Some believed the Axeman was a spirit, a lower, a ghost god of wrath and justice. Others thought he was a butcher or former convict. Still others said he was a vigilante, punishing sin. The only thing everyone agreed on, he didn't act like any normal criminal, because normal criminals don't disappear forever. Theories, suspects, and scapegoats. The New Orleans Police Department tried to pin the murders on someone, anyone. Their first suspect, grocer Louis Bissouma, was convenient. German-born, unfaithful, and already wounded. But no evidence linked him. They later blamed Frank Giordano, a teenage neighbor of the Cortimiglias, despite the fact that he couldn't possibly fit through the door panel the killer had carved open. None of it made sense. The modus operandi, chiseling through doors, attacking people as they slept, using their own axes, didn't match robbery. Nor was there a clear vendetta. And unlike most serial killers, the Axeman didn't escalate toward a sexual compulsion or ritual. He stayed silent, detached, random, yet calculated. Modern profilers believe the Axeman was someone who blended in easily, perhaps a handyman, carpenter, or laborer. Someone physically strong, with access to tools, a sociopath with no remorse. But the city at the time wasn't interested in criminal psychology. They wanted the nightmare to end, and when it did, they simply moved on. But the killings didn't vanish from memory. They transformed into folklore. The woman who claimed to know the truth. In 1921, 2 years after the final attack, a bizarre newspaper story surfaced. A woman named Josephine. Lang claimed to have known the identity of the Axeman. She said he was a man named Joseph Mumfre, a career criminal and blackmailer. According to Lang, Mumfrey had been involved in extorting Italian grocers, many of the same ones attacked. She also said he'd once tried to recruit her into his cult-like circle that dabbled in mysticism and violence. Most chillingly, Lang alleged that after she rebuffed Mumfrey, he killed her husband. She tracked him for years. And then, according to her sworn statement, she shot and killed Mumfrey in Los Angeles. But the story unraveled under scrutiny. Some parts couldn't be verified. Mumfrey's connection to the murders was circumstantial at best. And Lang? She disappeared soon after her confession. To this day, the Mumfrey theory remains controversial. Some investigators dismiss it outright. Others say it's the closest thing to a lead ever uncovered. But even if Mumfrey was involved, no solid evidence ever tied him to the Axeman's most infamous acts. A city that wanted to forget New Orleans never held a trial for the Axeman. No one was convicted. No official file closed the case. Instead, the memory was absorbed into the city's dark romanticism. Books and jazz records referenced him. Ghost tours name-drop him. Some believe the killer died, or left town, or found another city to haunt. Others say the music night, that single evening where jazz saved the city, satisfied his appetite. But deeper analysis suggests something more disturbing. The Axeman wasn't just a killer, he was a mirror. He emerged at a moment when New Orleans was grappling with identity. Waves of Italian and Sicilian immigrants were arriving, facing discrimination and suspicion. The police were corrupt. Many of the victims were Italian grocers, powerful within their own community, but targeted by extortion rackets and resented by others. Some believed the Axeman was a tool of organized crime. Others saw him as an avenger. But no one could say with certainty, because the crimes existed in a city too afraid to look closely. To admit the Axeman was real meant admitting that evil can be both intimate and random. That your own home, your own bed, your own axe could be used against you. That was a horror New Orleans couldn't face. So they turned him into legend. The music that saved a city and condemned it. The most iconic part of the Axeman saga remains that jazz-filled night of March 19th, 1919. Thousands played music to ward off death. In doing so, they surrendered to fear and to faith in something inexplicable. It's a moment that defies logic. No killer before or since has given such theatrical notice. No community has ever responded in such unison. To this day, scholars debate, was it a media hoax? A stunt by musicians or business owners? Or was it truly the killer himself, enjoying the power to bend a city to his will? There's no definitive answer. What's left is a story, one that blends truth and myth in perfect harmony, just like New Orleans itself. The Axeman vanished, but the rhythm of what he did, the beat of silence interrupted by terror, echoes still. Trial tapes. The Axeman's letter. Read aloud, Hell, March 13th, 1919. Esteemed mortal of New Orleans, they have never caught me, and they never will. They have never seen me, for I am invisible, even as the ether that surrounds your earth. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a demon from the hottest hell. I am what you Orleanians and your foolish police call the Axeman. When I see fit, I shall come and claim other victims. I alone know whom they shall be. I am fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared in whose home a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have just mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well then so much the better for you people. One thing is certain, and that is that some of those persons who do not jazz it on Tuesday night will get the axe. Well, as I am cold and crave the warmth of my native Tartarus, and as it is about time I leave your earthly home, I shall cease my discourse. hoping that thou wilt publish this, that it may go well with thee, I have been, and will be the axeman.